Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 6, Side 1. People had been disappearing. First the hotel cook, then some Swiss shopkeepers, then another and another, until now the hotel was no longer operating, and no shops were open at all. The shoemakers had vanished. The Germans who repaired things were no longer to be found. The llaneros had driven the large herds south, where they would have better winter feed, they said, and then they had vanished. Brown Limper had taken it up with Sniff. Did this have anything to do with the Brigantes? Even Turl put the question to him. But Sniff swore up and down he and his men had behaved. The academy was still there and operating. There seemed to be a vast number of pilot trainees and a vaster number of machine operators. But they stayed down at the academy, and all one saw was an occasional plane doing practice flights. All his office radios and teleprinters were gone. They broke down and had to be taken away to be repaired, and then they never came back. But never mind. Brown Limper couldn't operate them anyway, and couldn't really trust anyone else to. This new banknote was making a world of difference to his morale. He decided he would not pay the pilots in it. He'd get even with them. People would be hanging him, Brown Limper, on their walls now. On sudden impulse, he decided he had better mend his political fences with his own tribe, and show them this bill, of course. He called Lars and General Sniff, and they got into a mine passenger plane Lars kept in the parking lot and took off for the new village he had put his people in. Brown Limper was still admiring one of the banknotes he held in his hand. The thought of showing it off to the village people warmed him. He did not even mind the harrowing way that Lars Thorensen flew. Narrowly missing snow-covered peaks that were not even on their route, Lars set them down near the old mining town. But it all seemed deserted. Not a single plume of smoke rose from a fire. Not even the smell of it remained. Carrying a Thompson, Sniff scouted the place. Empty. Not even a trace of belongings. Nothing. Brown Limper searched, looking for a clue, dragging his club foot through the smooth snow from building to building. Finally, he found where they must have had a meeting. There were some torn scraps of paper lying about. And then, under a table where it might have fallen off a pile of papers unnoticed, he found a letter. It was from Tom Smiley Townsend. Brown Limper looked at it and went into an immediate rage. Not at what it said, but at Tom Smiley's having the effrontery to know how to write. What arrogance! But then he saw it was not really written, it was printed, and rather crudely at that. Even the signature was printed. So he decided to be tolerant and read it. The letter went on and on about how nice some area known as Tashkent was. Big mountains, endless plains of wild wheat, lots of sheep, and a mild winter climate. And how he had gotten married to some Latin. Disgraceful. No blood purity there. Brown Limper threw the letter down. Well, maybe the village people had gone back to their old home. They had not wanted to move. But he was surprised that the Indians and the people from the Sierra Nevadas and the other British Columbian fellow had not remained here, for they hadn't cared for the old village, too cold and too heavy a prospect of starving every winter. They flew to the old village. Lars had trouble setting down and almost landed in the middle of one of those uranium circles. When he could let go of his grip on the seat, Brown Limper looked around. No smoke here either. Brown Limper poked into some of the houses. When they had moved at such short notice, people had had to leave most of their personal possessions behind, and Brown Limper thought they must still be there. But no. Every house was empty. Not ransacked, the way Brigantes left places. Just neatly empty. With a bit of fear, because it had been booby-trapped, he approached the old Tyler house. It was still standing. Maybe the booby-traps hadn't gone off. Then he saw that some of the roof was bulged, and he went around to the other side to where the front door had been. The door had been blown off. Lars and Snith were poking at something in the snow. It was the remains of two Brigantes. What hadn't been burned had been torn apart by wolves. It was obvious they had tripped the booby traps, and quite a while ago. General Snith poked at the scraps of money, skin, and bones with the muzzle of the submachine gun.
"Moose hab come oop here, browling for loot," said Snith. "Waste of good meat."
Brown Limper wanted to be alone. He dragged his foot up the slope to the place they once had buried people. He turned at the top and gazed down at the empty village, falling apart and now abandoned forever. Something had been nagging at him, and now it hit him. He was a tribal leader without a tribe. From five tribes, he had descended to one, the Brigantes, and they were not native to America. Numbly, he realized he had better keep this awfully quiet. It undermined his whole position. Something caught his eye. A monument? A small stone shaft sticking up out of the ground. He moved around it. It had an inscription. Timothy Brave Tyler, a good father, erected in respectful memory by his loving son, J.G.T. Brown Limper screamed. He tried to kick the monument down. It was too firmly planted, and he only bruised his foot. He stood and screamed, tearing the echoes of the valley apart. Then he stopped. It was all Johnny Good Boy Tyler's fault. Everything that had befallen Brown Limper all his life was totally and wholly Tyler's fault. So Tyler would come again, would he? Turl might have his plans, and they might be all right. But Brown Limper was going to make very, very sure. If Tyler ever hit that firing platform again, he was a dead man. Brown Limper went down to the waiting plane. He said to Lars and Snith, they mustn't know what he really intended,
"For our mutual protection, I think you should teach me how to use a Thompson submachine gun."
They agreed it would be wise. Turl had said time and again you didn't dare shoot off a gun during a transshipment. But who cared about that? Two guns. He would use two guns. Brown Limper planned how he would do it all the way back to Denver. 3. The small gray man sat watching the strange antics of a terrestrial craft several miles above his orbit. The combined force had learned over a month ago to leave such a craft alone. Half-Captain Rogo Dieter Snowell, already in disgrace over trying to sneak a kidnap and cut them out of the potential loot, had charged his Vulcor-class cruiser, guns blazing, at a ship doing exactly what this one was doing. The strange craft had sidestepped neatly. There reportedly had been a series of clangs against the cruiser's hull. Snowell had pulled up, mystified as to what the clangs betokened. He had sent crewmen out on lines to inspect his hull, and they had been horrified to discover they had about 20 limpet mines on it, held solidly by magnetism to the hull. The terrestrial craft had apparently mined the orbit they used. Snowell had been further embarrassed to discover that the mines did not explode. They had atmosphere pressure fuses, which meant that if he brought the Vulcor-class cruiser within 100,000 feet of the planet's surface, the air pressure would explode them there. Every commander had hastily examined his whole ship to see if he had picked any up. They hadn't, but it meant to them that if you chased that terrestrial ship, it threw a cloud of mines in your path. Very unnerving. So they left it alone. The ship had a huge door in the side and a lot of cranes. The small gray man was no miner or military expert, but the ship was obviously collecting space debris. It wasn't using its cranes, so it must have a big magnet inside that door. Apparently, it would spot something on its screen. There were a lot of odd bits in orbit just now, as a large, strange comet had entered the system lately, evidently from some other system, and bits of it were floating around and occasionally hitting the meteor shielding of most of these ships. Then the terrestrial would go out and pace the object. Many of them were moving as fast as 19 miles a second, and suddenly dart sideways. The apparent magnets inside that door would collect it. Rather interesting, the small gray man thought. Somewhat like a hummingbird he had once seen, darting about after insects, stopping around a flower, and then zooming off. He needed something to occupy his mind. There was no word yet. Probably wouldn't be for another couple of months. No new courier had come to him, which seemed to mean that the one had not been found elsewhere. These were very troubled times. His indigestion had begun to act up again. About 3 weeks ago, he had gone down to see the old woman. He had run out of peppermint leaves. She had been glad to see him, and so had the dog. She had used the vocoder to start up some trade with the Swedes, and she had sold them some oats and some butter, and she was rolling in money. Look, 6 credits. Enough to buy an acre of ground or another cow. And she had been busy evenings. Cold weather had been coming on, and it must be an awful lot colder up there in the sky, and she had knitted him a nice gray sweater. The small gray man had the sweater on now. It was quite soft and warm. He touched it and felt a little sad. He had told those military men that it was politically inadvisable to try to operate in the Highlands of Scotland, and he thought they had listened. But just a week ago he had gone down to get some more peppermint, and the old woman was gone. The house was closed up. The dog was gone. The cow was gone. There seemed to be no sign of violence, but then you never knew with these military men. They could be very sneaky and thorough at times. He had dug up a few sprigs of mint from under the snow, but was quite troubled. Anything like sentiment was a foreign thing to him. But he had felt troubled nonetheless. These military men, they were so obsessed with finally smashing up this planet that they were quite restless when asked to wait for his courier. They got such silly ideas. They had noted that every plane and every installation down there now seemed to have a little creature in an orange-yellow robe. They couldn't understand the messages now being sent on the planet's radios. They had tried language machines, and none worked. Then they tried all their coding and scrambling machines, and none worked. All the messages seemed to begin and end with Om Mani Padme Om, like a sort of chant. That place in southern Africa near the big dam, the one the terrestrials had used to lure in and trap 2 raiding parties, was being all cleared out, and it gave them their first clue. A pagoda-like structure, several in fact, were being erected. They found in some old reference texts that the design was a religious temple. So the military men had agreed that the planet had now experienced a new political upheaval. Some religious zealots had taken over. Religions were very dangerous. They inflamed people. Any sensible government and its military should stamp them out. But they were not concerned with politics and religion just now. They would wait. The small gray man turned his attention from the terrestrial craft to the combined force. It had increased in number now to 13. New arrivals, other races. They had brought the news that there was a 100 million credit prize offered now to the ship or ships that discovered the one. Thus, they were more eager to raid and collect evidence than they were to gut the planet. Half-Captain Rogo-Dieter Snowell had become quite incensed with this place, obsessed with it, in fact. But his military sense was telling him that he was outnumbered by the rest of the combined force, and he had left a couple of weeks ago to return to his planet and bring up additional war vessels. It would get quite crowded in the orbits. His own captain had asked the small gray man whether he could draw off a bit from the rest. This was going to be an awful mess when these military men found out and could split the prize and then gut the planet. The small gray man had agreed. He returned to idly watching the terrestrial ship. It seemed to be finished now, possibly had a full hold. It was slowly going down into the atmosphere, making its way to the African base. 4. Johnny watched Stormalong's old orbit miner come in. A sentry turned off the atmosphere armor shield and let the plane through, and they turned it back on. There was always a faint sizzle from it when the power went on, but after that it was silent. Aside from some luckless birds and insects that hit it and sometimes left a feather or feelers, one wouldn't know it was there. All pilots had had to be warned, and a complex set of guard signals had had to be developed, lest some pilot crash his ship. Stormalong put the old ship alongside a metal pulverizer. The Cyclos used a device which first softened metal by breaking down its molecular cohesion, and then let it go through armored rollers that really tore it apart and smashed it. The result was a metal powder so fine that if one threw a handful into the air, a lot of it stayed there like fine dust. The Cyclos needed it that way for part of their fuel and ammunition processes. Using the ship's own cranes, the co-pilot began unloading the catch into the metal pulverizer. Stormalong got out and came over. 55 tons this trip, he said smugly. There's plenty up there, trapped in orbit. Think we'll need any more? Johnny wasn't sure. He had been on to other things. They walked down into the compound to verify. One of the Buddhist communicators came up. They had a way of moving which always intrigued Johnny. They would put their right hand into their left sleeve, and their left hand into their right sleeve, and then they would move their feet in a sort of fast trot shuffle. Their shoulders didn't bob. The result made them look like they were floating or scooting. Until yesterday, many had continued to wear their reddish-yellow robes. These, and their shaven heads, made them too easy to single out from above. A huge batch of packages and uniforms had come in from Ivan. People there had been reworking cloth sent to them from some looms now operating in Luxembourg. They were green uniforms with an armored aluminum helmet, also green. Johnny supposed that all their forces would be in these soon. The Buddhist was wearing his now. He bowed, always a bow, and handed Johnny a package. He was so very sorry. There was so much in, distribution was delayed. Johnny bowed back. It was contagious. He and Stormalong walked on through the compound looking for Angus. Johnny was opening his package. It was from Ivan. A helmet. Plain green like everyone else's. Ear pads put on that would lift. There was a letter. Some communicator had written it for Ivan, on top of the helmet. Dear Marshal Johnny, your village people arrived and are very happy, and so are we. Dr. Allen got the old man Jimson off some weed he was eating, and he looks like he will live. Your people all say, how do you do, hello? Tom Smiley also says, how do you do, hello? Your horses got shipped over here, and they are now learning to speak Russian. Joke. But they are fine. I worked on Blodgett, and she can run pretty good now. You must always look after horses. We got the Buddhist library down deep now, and it's safe. On the helmet, I wish I could tell you I had an angel visit me the night before you left that told me you had to wear it. Your letter thanking me is received with embarrassment. I was not trying to save your life, but I would any time anyway. So I can't accept your gratitude. It was no angel. I just knew that in those high mountains you can freeze your... scratched out. Ears off. This helmet is less conspicuous. I didn't even put a star on it. Give my best to Chrissy when you write. I hope somebody is looking after your clothes. Your comrade, Ivan. Colonel commanding Russian base until you can dig up some Americans.
It was a nice helmet, and it fit. There were a couple of small creases on it they hadn't quite rubbed out. Ivan must have fired some shots at it to make sure it would stop bullets. There was also a package of ammunition for the AK-47s. Johnny had advised them to bore a hole in the ends and put some thermite explosive powder in them, so they would be useful against Tallneps.
They said it worked, and they were converting. Stormalong and Johnny had arrived at the meteorite powder washing area. Four cyclo females were working hard, sloshing pans of metal powder around in huge tubs of mercury. They were gloved and clothed to protect them from mercury poisoning. When Stormalong had begun this orbit mining, it had been with an eye to training pilots, and, Johnny suspected, to gratify a craving for wild flying. The stuff collected was odd enough. Meteorites and such got caught in orbit or perihelion, and before they sizzled down through the atmosphere, they were often crystalline and quite amazing. Johnny was about to put a stop to it. It had served its purpose, scaring the visitors half to death with limpet mines. But Angus, always prowling into something, had noted some pieces in a recent batch that were of different chemical structure. An outer space comet, not native to the system, had been blasting across the skies for some time. Angus pointed out to Johnny that it contained the tiniest traces of the unknown element Turl had used for the center of his device. Angus had shown him on the analyzer. There they were. Microscopic traces of it. If the material had burned down through the atmosphere like meteorites usually do, the element might have vanished from the heat. But these virgin bits did contain it. Johnny had gone in circles for a day on how to extract it, and then remembered you could pan gold because it was heavier than dirt and rock. The cyclos used literally tons of mercury in some mining processes. So they got pans of it and tested it. Iron, copper, nickel, most elements now in powder form, were lighter than mercury and floated off or combined. But this strange element went to the bottom with a thud. It was terribly cohesive and clung to itself. It took an awful lot of powdered metal to get any. They could have rigged some machines to do the panning, but these cyclo-females couldn't care less about a big pan of mercury, and they happily sloshed it about, panning the powder. They smiled at Johnny. They were all right unless somebody foolishly mentioned mathematics. You would lose one cyclo-female right then. It had happened with Chirk, and again with another one. They said Angus would be back, and they waited for him. He reappeared presently, and they asked him, did he need any more? Angus shook his head and beckoned. In the shop where he was working, Angus had duplicated Turl's box with one exception. It didn't push all the elements together when you raised the lid. A timed piston did that. You set the time, and then the piston closed the rods. Angus had six of them. The center bit was probably not as pure a metal as Turl's, but they were sure that was of no importance. The weights were varied a bit, but all around 75 pounds for the center bit. Angus had not put the centers in place. He had those sitting well apart, and every one was making a dent in what it sat on. "Unless you've got a mind to blow up the universe," said Angus, "don't you think about 8 will do? The load you just brought in should give us 2 more." "But what does it do?" begged Stormalong. Johnny shook his head. "We don't know, but if Turl made one with that expression on his face, you can be very sure it is the deadliest weapon the cyclos have. One thing you be sure of, Angus. Pack the core separately and don't let anybody combine them on this planet. When you're all done, send them down to the underground armory in Kariba." Johnny went out. He was feeling fairly cheerful. Lots of good things were happening. The Chinese in Kariba said they had engineers, and they did. But they were engineers expert in wood and stone and bridges and things. They also had some painters, and that small bowl and its surrounds looked pretty strange, but artistic. They lined internal bunkers with tile they made. It was all very neat. They even had a little village of their own between the atmosphere armor cable and the shore of the lake made by the dam. Their anti-aircraft pits had little pagoda rain domes over them. Good progress was being made in America. It was almost cheerful. They might have a chance. Thin, but possible. Of course, there was the mathematics thing. Lately, All Turl seemed to do was scan pages and pages and pages of incomprehensible mathematical equations. He had not started building a console, but he was obviously figuring it out from scratch. The old one was burned out. He had demanded it anyway for its case, and they had brought him all kinds of scrap, but none was it. It couldn't be, for Johnny had the original console, a burned-to-a-crisp wreck, down in the garage here. So Turl would even have to do the metal case. Johnny saw a couple of Hockners being taken to another room. These prisoners fought each other, race to race, like wildcats. The tallest Hockner, not too bad-looking in spite of having no nose, was a lower-grade officer, but educated. He was showing vast interest in the vehicles parked around. Johnny stopped the group, intending to ask some questions. The tall Hockner was grinning superciliously at the vehicles. Ordinary Hockner crewmen didn't speak Cyclo, but their officers did. He recognized Johnny. "You know," said the tall one, "that none of these vehicle frames are built on Cyclo, don't you?" "I didn't know," said Johnny. Although it made the sentries wary, the Hockner went over to a ground car and looked around under the edge of one of the bumpers. "There," he said, pointing. Johnny looked at it. It was one of the alphabets on the galactic banknotes. "That's Duraleb," said the Hockner. "It says, Made in Duraleb. The Cyclos import all their plane bodies and tank bodies and machinery from other systems and peoples. The Cyclos only furnish metals, and then motors and consoles. Nobody can use this stuff except Cyclos, since nobody has the drives. These other planets build other things for other peoples, but this Cyclo stuff is useless if you don't have consoles. They make those on Cyclo, and only on Cyclo." Johnny thanked him. He said, "Don't thank me, old fellow. If you ever start running out of consoles and motors, while you can buy all the bodies you want, you won't have a thing. It's the way the confounded Cyclos run things. They've got a throat-choke monopoly on every universe. You can't go up against them. Hockners have tried. You'll just lose." Johnny knew these prisoners, while cooperative, tended to be malicious. But he had heard this too often for it to be just a guess. He changed the subject. "Did you fellows ever capture any cyclomathematics texts?" The Hockner gave a laugh. It sounded like a horse neighing. "My dear fellow, every wizard brain in the universe for 302,000 years has tried to figure out cyclomathematics. It can't be done." "Oh, it isn't their arithmetic. An 11-numeral system is not too strange. There's a race that had 23 different numerals. It's their silly equations. Nothing ever balances. Texts? Anybody can pick up their texts. They're meaningless. Pure rubbish. Balderdash. Rot. Now, will you order them to give me and my crew something to eat, like you did the Tallnep?" Johnny told them to see McKendrick. He went to his viewing room and looked at Turl's vast numbers of worksheets again. He wasn't feeling so good now. Johnny had a bomb to land on Cyclo if necessary. Great. He didn't have a thing to land it there with. He had a rapidly growing force of visitors overhead. Turl was dawdling. Johnny had a very desperate plan to seize the console before it could be destroyed. But even if he got it, it might work just once and quit if the Tallnep was right. He looked over Turl's equations again. They didn't balance. They didn't proceed one to the next logically. Yet the whole fate of this planet depended, in the final analysis, on solving them. Maybe other people of other races had met this impasse, this same problem before, and lost. Maybe another being had sat here like this, staring at texts and worksheets of cyclomath, uneasy, and with a feeling of hopelessness, and then gone out to be destroyed by the cyclos, his personal courage meaningless. 5. Turl was getting suspicious. It was a whole series of little things. First, there was the trouble with the money, and trouble with money was one thing Turl would not tolerate. They had his contracts, and Turl had supposed they would simply hand it over in due course. But no. It seemed the 2 billion galactic credits had been safeguarded in the Denver branch of the Earth Planetary Bank. Worse, it also seemed that this brown limper staffer was running up huge bills and loans with the Earth Planetary Bank. The most recent had been one to build a castle up on a hill. He wanted to call it Bergsdorfen, or some such thing. Brown limper staffer to get the money had offered as collateral the Turl contracts. Directors of the Earth Planetary Bank, a man named McAdam and a German, had turned up here at the compound with new documents for Turl to sign. And unless they were signed, then the galactic credits could not be turned over. The last thing Turl wanted was valid evidence lying about. But there was no help for it. McAdam said the original contracts were not properly notarized, and no one had attested to the signature. Turl had signed them with his left paw since he hated the idea of all this evidence. He could have claimed the first contracts were forgeries he knew nothing about. But these bankers had typed up brand new, much more valid-looking contracts. The new ones attested that Turl was political officer, war officer, security officer, and acting head of Intergalactic Mining Company. True enough, locally. It was pointed out that there was no Earth branch of the company, that there was just the company as a whole. So Turl had to sign as acting for the whole board of Intergalactic Mining Company, and the contract sold the company and any interests the company might have that could be sold, transmitted, conveyed. You could read this contract in a way that sold all of Intergalactic everywhere, and all its planets. Or you could read it that it was just this planet and this branch. Very general. It made Turl's claws curl in fear. If the Imperial government of Cyclo learned of this, they would take days to torture him to death. Not in over 300,000 years had Intergalactic ever sold any part of itself or its interests. They had brought a Swiss notary and witnesses. The contract was in English, German, and Cyclo. It had 15 originals that had to be signed. But no sign, no money. Turl, rage and fear suppressed, had signed every copy. And then Brown Limper had signed as the custodian of interests for any legally constituted government of the planet, said contract binding on all successors. And then had also signed an addition to it conveying the contract to the Earth Planetary Bank to have and to hold and to execute or convey in return for sums advanced. With horror, Turl saw this document witnessed, stamped, covered with red seals, covered with gold seals, and packaged in wax seals. 15 separate copies of it. But they gave him his money. They said the Denver branch of the bank was closing, and they could not keep it there, and Turl had to take it right now. Turl raised no objection to that. They brought the boxes on a flatbed truck and put them in his bedroom. They gave Turl his copies of the contract, and he signed a receipt for those and the money. They all left, and the moment they were out the door, his first act was to shred, burn, and destroy the ashes of his copies. If Cyclo ever got word of it? He felt soothed then, and he sat and petted the money for a while. Then he realized he couldn't go to bed amid all these boxes. He got the guards to let him go out to the morgue and get 3 coffins. It seemed to him that there were fewer coffins there than there used to be. However, he brought the coffins in and put them in the bedroom and got to work putting the money into them, counting it by bundles. It was late and he still hadn't finished the job, so he spread some blankets on one of the coffins and went to sleep. The next day, still working on packing the money, he had never realized before what an enormous lot of money 2 billion credits was. He found he was short 1 coffin. It was going to take 4. Accordingly, he got the guards to let him out, and he went to the morgue to get another coffin. On his last visit, there had been one quite close to the door. Now it was no longer there. Somebody was doing something with these coffins. Only a security chief of Churl's talents and training ever could have gotten to the bottom of it. That he was sure of. First he questioned guards. Then he questioned a Captain Arf Moifi. And he found these Brigantes, these allegedly reliable trained mercenaries, had been trafficking in coffins with the cadets. The night duty commando had been selling coffins to the cadets for whiskey. Whiskey was some drink made in Scotland. Intoxicating. Oh, Churl got the whole story. Late of an evening, some cadet, different ones, would come to the compound with an open pail of whiskey and trade it for a coffin. The guard would simply open the morgue and hand one over and take the whiskey. It did no good for Captain Arf Moifi to show him that the cadets used the lead to make little cast-model spaceships and soldiers. He even had a couple. Churl knew those. They were for a game called Klep. Those cadets were selling game pieces and game boards made out of melted-down lead coffins. Company coffins. Churl had demanded to see Snith. He ordered him to put a stop to it. 3 days later, Churl had gotten himself escorted down to the metal supply storeroom to get some needed sheets of material when he noticed that the hangar was nearly empty. There were a few ore carriers and a half dozen battle planes, and that was all that was left in those vast hangars. He had promptly gone to the garage, and that, too, was nearly empty. There were just a dozen flatbeds and a couple of basher tanks left in there. The place was being stolen blind. He got hold of Lars and raged at him. Lars said there had been a lot of crashes and the cadets were simply replacing the lost machines from the hangar. Just as he was about to rip Lars to bits, it suddenly occurred to Turl that company property was no longer his responsibility. So he let it go. 3 days later, there was a tearing argument with Care. Sometime since, they had begun to clear away the wreckage and fused wires of the old transshipment rig, and now that it was gone, Turl wanted to be sure that the points would be at the correct distances on the poles. He went out, and he found Care using the most sloppy, inexperienced machine operator trainees he had to dig the trench for the atmosphere armor ionization cable. There was the trench, half dug. But these trainees had been digging all over the place. And more, there was equipment scattered everywhere. Cranes, blade scrapers, you name it. Whenever one of these stupid animal trainees had dug something, he had simply left the machine there. Whenever he lifted something, he left the magnetic crane right there. What a mess. Standing on the platform, hating the bright winter sun, half sick from the rotten quality breathe gas that was available, Turl had felt like clawing the midget to bits.
You know better than this, raged Turl. Can I help it if these animals break machines? Shouted Care. Can't you follow a straight, plain plan? Shouted Turl.
Can I help it if these animals can't follow a straight, plain line? Shouted Care.
Turl realized Care had a point. They weren't going to get anywhere standing here shouting.
Look, said Turl, it is in your own best interest that I get safely to Cyclo.
It is, said Care.
Leverage, leverage, Turl told himself. I'll tell you what I will do, said Turl. I will put 10,000 credits to your account in the Galactic Bank. You have a numbered account there with quite a bit in it already. But I will add,
Brown Limper Staffer paid me 100,000 Earth credits just to dig up that cable for you. That cable right over there. It was no easy job, and I considered the pay cut rate.
Turl thought fast.
All right. I'll pay you 100,000 Galactic credits to help install this firing rig and cooperate.
I can get double that from this Brown Limper not to do it, said Care.
You can,
said Turl, suddenly alert. He thought hard.
Yes, that Brown Limper had been acting furtively lately, like he was hiding something. He wants a certain party, said Care. He doesn't care if you get to Cyclo or not.
But doesn't he know I have to record the deeds?
He's only interested in getting one man, said Kerr.
Look, said Turl, I will put 500,000 credits in your account if you cooperate in getting me to Cyclo.
Kerr thought about it. Then he said,
if you will get me some new papers and destroy my old company records, and deposit 750,000 credits to my account, I'll see all goes smoothly.
Turl was about to say he agreed when Kerr spoke again.
You will have to make it all right with this Brown Limper staffer also. Tell me how you intend to trap this man so I can reassure this staffer. He controls these workers. So add that, and it's a deal.
Turl looked at Kerr. He knew how money-hungry he was.
All right. I'm going to string 500 Brigantes around outside that atmosphere armor, armed with poisoned arrows. Arrows won't make a concussion if fired, and they can shoot that animal to bits if he comes. You whisper that to Staffer, and he'll also cooperate with you. It's a deal, then?
Kerr smiled. Turl went back inside, glad to get his breathe mask off. He got some Kerbango to soothe his nerves. He reviewed this strange scene. It was Staffer. That was the one who was going to mess this plan up. Turl would take care of the animal. He hadn't told Kerr he also intended to have Snith and a squad on the platform, armed with poisoned arrows, or that he had a beautiful beryllium box to hand Staffer. The box would destroy all the evidence, the contract copies, everything. And Kerr, too. He would have a hostage to handle the animal. He felt quite satisfied about everything until 3 nights later, when he noticed there were no guards in view. He went out, and there they were, sprawled around the morgue, dead drunk. It was obvious that Snith had used the information just to get a commission in whiskey. Well, he could handle Snith when the time came. The one to keep an eye on was this Staffer. His suspicions were right. It was Staffer that was plotting. Sneaky rat. It was plain he would try to steal this money back. Warned, Turl was confident he could outsmart them all. He went in and checked the money coffins, sealed them, marked them radiation killed so nobody on Cyclo would want to open them, and put his private X on the bottom of each one. He would be a wealthy tycoon on Cyclo. He spread his bedding out on top of the coffins and slept a beautiful sleep with beautiful dreams, where royalty bowed when they met the great Turl on the street. And all evidence, and this planet, would have been totally destroyed behind him. 6. Deep in the African mine site, bent over the view screens in the half-lit dark, Johnny was taking a loss. Day 92 was coming up on them like a whirlwind. At first he had hoped that he could get a separate console built, using Turl's plans, and install it down at Kariba. Such would bypass any real necessity for a hopeless attack in America to seize that one. It looked as if it remained their best chance, but it was hardly any chance at all. He would have had to stop Turl from using that strange bomb, but he could not do that without the almost foolhardy risks of letting it go right on up to the firing time on day 92 and trying to attack the platform and grab that console at the last moment. Other news was not good. There had been 2 more raids by the visitors in different places, and casualties had been suffered. An ore plane, returning empty from a ferrying trip, had been swooped down upon by the Hawvins and blasted out of the sky with the loss of both pilot and co-pilot. A hunting party from the Russian base had been gunned from above, and 3 Siberians and a Sherpa had been killed before their air cover had shot down the intruder. Also, the Edinburgh defense planning had gone wrong. Sir Robert had wanted to bring in a couple of miles of atmosphere cable and surround Castle Rock with it. The power dams in Scotland of long ago were not in shape or converted to cyclo power. The Cornwall mineside power supply was a tidal dam at Bristol in the Bristol Channel, and while it worked well on the ebb and flow of those gigantic tides, it was not possible to run a line clear up to Edinburgh, and that line would have been open to attack in any case.
Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 6, Side 2. The Cornwall Mineside Power Supply was a tidal dam at Bristol in the Bristol Channel, and while it worked well on the ebb and flow of those gigantic tides, it was not possible to run a line clear up to Edinburgh, and that line would have been open to attack in any case. The hauling of that much cable itself was a formidable block, for it would have had to be flown in sections to Scotland. No other means than anti-aircraft fire was available to protect Edinburgh, and the Scots, having regained it, were not going to abandon it. It was the center of the most ancient Scottish nationalism. Moving the whole remaining population down to Cornwall, as proposed by Johnny, had not been approved, and it was true it would be pretty crowded. Johnny knew Edinburgh was going to catch it. Tyrrell was going about his job in a way that seemed backward. He spent a lot of time measuring up poles and stringing outside wire and putting in firing points. Everything he did was being duplicated exactly down at Kariba. They now had the wires up and all the points in down at that base. Angus, each time they got a new item, would go tearing down to Kariba and install an equivalent in the secondary defense platform there. It had looked very hopeful for some days. Tyrrell had gotten a lot of metal and had built the console case, a heavy, massive thing about a yard square. They had built the same case here, and it was sitting down in a locked room, an empty shell, waiting. But after all this spurt of energy, Tyrrell, for the last several days, had just been fooling with fuses. He wasn't getting on with construction. Reams of mathematics had been worked out by Tyrrell, but a lot of good they were, who understood them. Now it was just fuses. Johnny had gotten duplicates out of supply here of all the fuses Tyrrell was working with, and tried to figure out what he was doing. Johnny had learned one thing, that some of the items in a console that would appear to be different components were fakes. They were not resistors or capacitors. They were actually fuses made up to look like other things. Tyrrell was doing something Johnny had not heard of before. With meters and such, he was working with an underload type of fuse. The circuit would be connected only so long as current was going through it. When the current ceased to flow, the fuse burned out. It was an odd kind of circuit breaker, made of a filament so tiny and thin it had to be worked under a magnifying scope. Well, that seemed to be all Tyrrell was doing. Johnny's attention was drifting when he suddenly realized that the filament Tyrrell was using looked awfully like the ones in the silver capsule in Cyclo heads. Forgotten was his stiff neck. He went tearing out and got one they had removed from a corpse. Yes, the same thing. Abruptly, he added it all up and rushed out to find McKendrick. The doctor was working with a cyclo skull he had cleaned and whitened. He was trying to find some means of entering it with instruments. He put it down on the table before him, where the sockets stared sightlessly at him, and composed himself to listen to Johnny. "That isn't anything very mysterious," said Johnny, pointing excitedly into the silver capsule he held. "It's just a fuse. It doesn't vibrate or put out radio signals or anything. It's just a fuse." Johnny grabbed some pictures of one inside a cyclo brain. "Look, you said the nerves this was fastened between were the primary impulse channels of their thought. All right, mathematics is logical thought. It is the approximation of being sensible. Now, even if a cyclo has a soul and does his thinking with a soul, or even if he doesn't have, mental action works between those two channels. So long as a cyclo is thinking logically, there is a constant current between those two nerves.
even asleep, there would be a current, a very slight one. Now up comes an alien. The Cyclo knows his whole race and empire depends upon keeping his mathematics a secret. And the alien wants to know about Cyclo mathematics. The Cyclo instantly shuts off thinking about them. Or a surge occurs and then a shut-off. Pop. Blown fuse. McKendrick was quite interested, but he said, "That doesn't explain suicide." "All right, look at this picture and look at this fuse. The silver capsule is very close to that bronze item that short-circuits pleasure and pain and action. Look at this fuse filament. When it parts, the ends drop down inside the capsule and you get a short circuit into the bronze item. The Cyclo has an instant impulse to kill. If he can't right then, the short circuit between the silver and bronze items acts as an obsession to kill that doesn't let up. He has to kill something, and he winds up killing himself." McKendrick thought it over and nodded. "But," he said, "that doesn't explain the females." Johnny got that type of capsule and looked at it. "It's another kind of fuse. Since mathematics is logical thought, it would cause a concentration of current to begin. They probably are taught not to teach females mathematics. It's part of their moral code. And the females are noted for being illogical. When they start to think in mathematical terms, or even try to, a current gets too heavy and they blow the fuse. They don't have a bronze object, and they just go into a coma. Their wits won't connect anymore, and they go out of communication with the nervous system." Johnny paused. "My explanation may not be complete, but I know these are just fuses and short circuits, and that's how they protected their empire."
"And why they're so crazy," said McKendrick. "I am sure you have the explanation, and that those things are what you say they are."
McKendrick turned the Cyclo's skull around on the table. It was a huge, massive, heavy thing. A complex mass of bone and joints.
"There's only one thing wrong."
Johnny was all revved up with having gotten that far. He listened.
"We're no closer to getting those things out of their heads than we were," said McKendrick.
Johnny laid the pictures and the capsules down on the table beside the skull and walked quietly out of the room. It was definitely not a hopeful day. 7. Johnny lanced northwest in the Mark 32 battle plane. The alert had come just over half an hour ago. Glenn Cannon was in trouble. It was day 78, only 14 days before Turl had scheduled himself to fire. He had not begun his panel on the last discs Johnny had had. There had been a delay. And now this. Glenn Cannon was under attack en route. The visitors, 400 miles above Earth, had increased. There were 18 of them now. Half-Captain Rogo Dieter Snaul had come back, and with him, he had brought 4 heavy war vessels. One of them, at least, if not more, was a plane carrier. It was probably from this that the attack on Glen Cannon had been launched. Johnny had no communicator with him. He had simply been outside when the alert came. Stormalong and 2 other pilots had scrambled, and Johnny had simply grabbed an air mask and a plane. All the communication in the air right now was in Poly. Both Glen Cannon and Stormalong had communicators with them and were using them. Thus, Johnny could not tell what was happening. The sing-song of the Buddhists never showed excitement, even in combat, so their voice tones told him nothing. He was gaining altitude and widening his view screens. He had Stormalong and the other 2 ships just ahead of him. He had not yet picked up Glen Cannon. Johnny threw a scanner upward. 3 of the visitors were way up there, not as clear in this bright daylight as they would be on scanners at night, due to daytime ultraviolet in the air. Was that the Volcor-class vessel? The other 2 with it were larger, more bulky. Yes, that was the Volcor-class. Diamond-shaped bridge. Half-Captain Rogo Dieter Snaul himself. The 3 weren't coming down. Apparently it took a lot of solar accumulation to do that, and they tended to reserve themselves. The other 2 must be plane carriers. Yes. From one of them came a new launch. Six needle-like craft were coming down like arrows. Clearly, using Cyclo, Johnny said, six new Hornets from above. That would warn Storm along. There was Glen Cannon, streaking along at about 100,000 feet, flat out, heading for the mine site. Where was his escort? He should have an escort. No sign of them. Four needles were shooting along behind Glen Cannon. Occasionally, a long-range flash of fire laced out from them. There went Storm along. In tight formation, the three planes cut straight through the pursuing Tallneps. An explosion, a second gout of hot blue flame, and a third. There was only one Tallnep racing out of the smoke. Johnny turned up to intercept the six coming down. They grew larger and larger in his sights. He centered on the nose of the leader. His thumb hit the firing trip as he wildly swung sideways, sweeping his awesome firepower into the Tallnep's tight formation. His view screen flared out with the explosions ahead. A slight thump as a broken piece of a Tallnep plane touched his wing. Johnny flipped around as they went by him. He sighted in on the tail of the last ship. He hit the trip of the blast cannon. He was skidding so wildly from his turn that he missed. Four Tallneps left to go. He flashed ahead of them and spun about. He was almost head-on with the Tallnep now leading. An instant before they would have collided, Johnny's shot stuffed the Tallnep's own fire up his cannon barrels. The ship exploded. Three Tallneps left. They looped and came on, firing in formation. The air about Johnny was slashed. The Mark 32 took a hit in the windscreen. Half of it went black. Johnny's guns were going. One Tallnep. Two Tallneps. The last one tried to make a run for it, shooting back into the heights. Johnny steadied his battle plane. He threw the firing sets onto flame and maximum range. He sent searching needles straight up. The Tallnep shattered into a ragged ball of fire. Where was Glen Cannon? There he was, racing down to the mine site, almost there. He had a Tallnep right on his tail. Stormalong and his other two ships were slashing down on the Tallnep. The guard opened the atmosphere armor curtain, and Glen Cannon flashed through. He was safe. A scythe of fire hit the Tallnep as Stormalong and the other two pilots let drive from extreme range. The guard got the atmosphere curtain on. The Tallnep hit it and slammed through. The air had not had time to reionize enough. The Tallnep ship exploded in a ball of flame in the scramble area, narrowly missing Glen Cannon's ship as it landed. Johnny and Stormalong scanned the skies for more enemy. There was none. Some smoke palls rose in the distance where enemy ships had disintegrated. The guard opened the atmosphere curtain. A firefighting crew was there now, spraying the burning wreckage of the Tallnep ship. Johnny, Stormalong, and the other two landed. Glen Cannon was sitting in his seat still. His Buddhist communicator was trying to calm him. Glen Cannon was crying. His hands were shaking. It was a reaction of total frustration.
I had orders to come through, Glen Cannon was repeating over and over.
The communicator waved the others away and then came to them.
There are many things for the Academy of Pilots to do in America, the Buddhist told Johnny and Stormalong. They also have to maintain their air cover. There were no escort pilots and we delayed coming for days. Then Glen Cannon felt he could not delay any more. A Swiss pilot, a close friend of his, but a very new pilot, volunteered. The Tallneps hit us just after we crossed the coast in northern Africa. It was too far away for Cornwall or Luxembourg to help us. The Swiss fought them off. He shot down three. But he needed help, and Glen Cannon had orders to keep going in such an event, and he kept going. He feels that if he had turned back to help the Swiss, they wouldn't have got him. The Swiss pilot was alone. He had no communicator, but he also told Glen Cannon to keep going. The Tallneps shot the Swiss to pieces. When he ejected and tried to get down by backpack, they closed in and killed him in the air.
Glen Cannon wants to go up and shoot down those ships in orbit. They would murder him. Please, help. They got Glen Cannon calmed down. Stormalong said that he would call Sir Robert and get the vital communication line made more secure. Sir Robert was going over to move the Academy out of America and to the Cornwall mine site in a few days. But meanwhile, better arrangements should be made. The ferrying of innumerable planes and equipment to safe places was now all complete. The tribes were centralized. Stormalong also said he would take over the run. Glen Cannon handed over the pouch of discs. Johnny looked at the packet. He hoped it was worth it. 8. It was. Minutes after Johnny opened the courier pouch and got a disc on a view screen, he realized that for the first time in all of Cyclo's long and sadistic history, non-Cyclo eyes were looking upon the actual construction of a teleportation transshipment console. Turl, having no models or patterns, was working from scratch. And crazy though he might be, his workmanship was exact. Of course, his own life depended upon its being so. He had already made the console case. He had fitted the rows of buttons, spares from the storerooms, all properly marked, into the panel top. He had made the screw holes which held the top onto the bottom case. Watching the view discs, fascinated, Johnny saw him take a yard-square piece of common black insulating board, the kind that was used to back all electronic assemblies, and fit it into the area between the top panel and the case sides. It was this board, evidently, which would hold the various components of the circuit he would build. He carefully and precisely drilled the holes in this insulating board, so it would fit between the top panel and the case and be held in place by the same joining screws. He temporarily fastened down the board in the case and put a smear of powder over it, and then pressed each button so the location where it touched the board was exactly marked. Then he took it all apart again and made more exact marks with a red pencil wherever the powder had been dented. He drilled small holes in each one of these points and put in a metal plug. Now the buttons of the top panel, when pressed, would come down and touch a metal plug. Turl now turned the insulating board over. The little metal plugs showed on the underside. He marked which was the top and which was the bottom of the board and really went to work. Scarcely consulting his notes and formulas at all, he began to cover the underside of the board with various electronic components, resistors, capacitors, tiny amplifiers, relays, and switches. It was actually a rather crude and old-fashioned sort of layout. It seemed to match up to the metal plugs the buttons would hit from above and often connected to it. But there was an oddity. He was putting fuses in places where, if you used the board at all, they would certainly blow. In fact, for every metal plug through the board, there was a fuse that would disconnect it from the circuitry now being built. It looked to Johnny that all you had to do was hit one button on the upper console, and a fuse would blow. Dozens of such fuses. In a dumb kind of way, this mysterious circuit he was building made sense, all except these fuses. Why would one put fuses all through a piece of electronic circuitry? Turl neatened up this whole complicated circuit. He color-coded it and polished it. And at last it was complete. It really looked marvelous, if one admired all the complexities of an electronic circuit board. It almost made sense. You pushed a top console button and current went here. You pushed another and current would go there. The board was complete. Turl admired it, even took a break and bit off some Kerbango. Then he did the strangest thing imaginable. With a flourish of his paws, he hooked up some leads to a power source, snapped the clips to the terminals of the very artistic board circuit he had just built, and blew all the fuses in it. They went with little glowing pops and smoke puffs. He had just made the whole circuit inoperational. Now he really got down to work. He pulled over his vast pile of equations and worked out formulas,
got out my chronometer measuring tools, cleaned up a set of drafting triangles and rulers, sharpened up white marking pens to a hairline point. He turned the board he had just made over to the blank side, made some reference points on it, and for the next 2 days, meticulously consulting his notes, he drew in a circuit. Aside from matching up with the metal plugs for the console buttons, this new circuit had nothing whatever to do with the one he had so laboriously built on the bottom side of the board. He drew in the resistors and amplifiers and capacitors and every other electronic component, all in tiny lines and squiggles and curls. Turl consulted his equations and worksheets and duplicated the measurements with enormous exactitude in white on the board. It was a long and complicated procedure, and it was a very complex circuit that emerged. The console buttons, when pressed, would activate it if it were composed of wire. He got that finished. Then he dusted the whole drawing with a thin coating of reddish paste. You could see the circuit through it, but when you put something on the paste, like a pencil, it would show that that bit of the circuit had been traced. Turl now got a thin-bladed annealing knife. One end of these knives, by the process of separating molecules through destruction of their cohesion, cut metal. The other end was used to restore the molecular cohesion and sew the metal up. He took the sewing end of the knife and began to trace his circuit with it. Wherever he followed a line, the thin red paste showed he had followed it. Thus, he could keep track of where he had traced and work without any skips. Johnny stared at this activity. Then he rushed out of his viewing room, raced up to one of the compound storerooms, and got a piece of insulating board and an annealing knife. He made a diagonal mark across the board with the sewing end of the knife. He put clips at both ends of his mark and put current through it. The current flowed. By aligning usually insulative molecules in a straight line, one had a path, a wire. He had seen that cyclos, in cutting these boards to size to install circuit breakers, always sawed them. He had just thought knives didn't work on them. True enough, knives were not efficient in cutting them. But by aligning molecules, the insulating board conducted electricity at the points of touch. Johnny, starry-eyed, went back to further view this activity Turl had been engaged upon. It had taken Turl 2 days just to trace that circuit. Finally, he finished. And then Turl took some solvent and a rag and wiped the whole board clean. There was not one visible trace left. But that insulating board now contained all the alignments of a complex circuit. The underside's visible components were a total fake. They weren't ever intended to work, and anybody examining one of these boards would think he had blown its fuses. Scientists of many races had probably spent hundreds of years of time trying to make that false circuit make sense and agree with cyclomath. Turl was doing something in the upper left corner of the board. Unfortunately, he had carelessly dropped a text open in such a position that its cover obscured much of what he was doing. It had something to do with the installation of a switch. It was a switch that would appear in the top panel. All Johnny could see on the disks was that the switch probably had to be changed with every use of the board. Up one firing, down the next, up the next, and so on. The switch was misleadingly labeled dimmer. The component it was attached to was visible enough. If activated by a wrong turn of the switch, that component would send a surge through the board and erase the invisible circuit. Johnny couldn't see what position the switch was rigged to be in at the first firing. Turl now was putting the board together. And Johnny found why loosening the screws, which held it all together, made the board inoperational. Turl took a large electromagnet and put it around the case. Then, just inside one screw where it went through the insulating board, he inserted a fuse. Johnny went down and got one. It was a magnet fuse. As long as a current went through it, it stayed whole. The moment a magnetic current was absent, it blew. To remove a console top, one had to put a magnetic field around the console. When the screw was touching the top edge of the console, the magnetic top edge kept a tiny current running forever. The moment that screw was loosened, the magnetic current ceased and the fuse blew. More, when it blew, it activated one of the components just under it and wiped the invisible circuit out of the board. But to take a panel top off, all you had to do was put a magnetic field generator near that screw and the fuse wouldn't blow. An invisible circuit, two booby traps to wipe it out, a completely false circuit to distract. And that was the secret of the cyclos. A sober Johnny made plentiful copies of Turl's circuit. One could simply put it on a piece of insulating board and trace it in. The metal plugs through it activated the invisible circuit. They could duplicate it. All except for one switch. And that was why he was sober. Exactly how it was rigged, he did not know. The position it would have to be in for each sequential firing, he did not know. He reviewed the discs again. No, he could not make it out. He speculated on the possibility of just making several boards and working it out. No, it might do something else, too. He made a full file and plenty of notes. They couldn't make teleportation motors from this, but possibly they could open them and trace the circuit. Maybe. But without that one switch... Johnny knew they would have to go over and seize that console just to see where Turl set it. It was an appalling risk and might cost men's lives. He knew they would have to do it. 9. Johnny quietly and efficiently neatened up his scene. In case anything happened to him, which he felt was more than likely in this American raid, he carefully briefed Angus in all the intricacies of the console. He made copious notes, especially for Angus, so that he could duplicate and operate such a console. He told him some of the things that could be done with it. Angus objected violently to Johnny's going on the raid. Johnny said he was not going to risk anyone else's life, for the actions he had to take were too dicey. He would have the backup of 30 Scots, 10 drivers, and 15 pilots. Angus was still trying to protest, but it didn't do any good. If Robert the Fox had been there, the two of them might have prevailed. But Sir Robert was over in America moving the academy, and Angus gave in reluctantly. A Scot aide of Sir Robert's was there, and Johnny briefed him on the military aspects of their situation. The visitors were waiting for something. He was not sure what. Johnny felt it had to do with whether or not they got a transshipment rig operating. An analysis of their chatter among themselves showed they were observing the American compound, waiting for something to happen. The visitors had seen cyclos there, probably Turl and Care, and seemed to think the American scene might still be in cyclo hands, or in any event, might be political. Johnny expected the sky to fall in right after that transshipment rig was fired, and an alert should be out, then, for Day 92, which was approaching very quickly. Johnny briefed another Scot officer and arranged a decoy platform to be hastily built in the Singapore area. There was a mine site there northwest of the ancient, deserted man city where the cyclos had mined tin, titanium, and tungsten. It had full hydroelectric power, atmosphere armor, and a certain amount of stores and planes left in it. A handful of Chinese, three pilots, a communicator, a coordinator, and this officer were to play out a platform and poles. Johnny gave them the old burned-out console, which they repainted. Under the protection of the cable, they were to make like they were busy firing, complete with things appearing and disappearing on the platform. When the flights left the American area with the real console, the heaviest part of the escort would streak to the Singapore area and pull any pursuit of the real console away. The Kariba platform had been under camouflage nets from the beginning, and chatter from the visitors showed they thought it was a temple. He warned the officer that the attack would be heavy there in the Singapore area, but the Scot just smiled and grabbed his allocated men and left. Johnny made a fast tour of Kariba. The Chinese had done wonderfully well. There was a roof under the screen, but over the firing platform, all held together with wooden pegs. Swooping gables and points made it very artistic. They had a lot of dragons around, carved from wood and cast in clay, that pointed out from the beam ends with flaming mouths and scaly tails. They had bunkers inside the protected cone. They all had tiled interiors. They even had a little hospital. Their own village was inside the protective cable over by the lakeshore. It was all very colorful and attractive, more like a garden than a war area. Dr. Allen had gotten some juice of plants from up in the old Nairobi area, he called it pyrethrum, that killed insects very efficiently. And despite the number of animals in the woods thereabouts that attracted flies, they had had no trouble with tsetse sleeping sickness. Johnny heard them singing and playing on strange string and wind instruments that evening, so he recorded a lot of it and had them rig loudspeakers ready to play it when they activated the area. It would foul up any listening beams from upstairs. That, plus the interference the armor cable posed, would keep them ignorant of what was going on here. When he returned to the African compound, it was day 87. He found Stormalong there with more disks that showed the color codes of the cables and the pole wires. They could simply hack off the console's cables and reconnect them at Kariba. He gave the code to Angus. Stormalong said this would be his last run, so Johnny briefed him carefully on the military situation. It was Johnny's belief that the visitors would attack in force after any American firing. Stormalong had better be prepared to take control of air defenses on the planet. Johnny would not let him go on the raid. Donald Dean was handling air cover for them on that. Thor would be with them in the raiding party. Johnny missed Robert the Fox, who usually handled these briefings and actions. Stormalong, like Angus, did not want Johnny to go. He said America was stripped now. The academy was empty. Johnny would have only his own raiding party, and though he knew it had been drilled within an inch of the participants' lives, there were an awful lot of Brigantes over there. Just after they had pulled the recorders out of the three places at the academy, Brigantes had begun to systematically loot the place. But with no Sir Robert to support his objections, Stormalong did not prevail. Johnny was going up to an upper level of the compound, and he ran into Care. The Cyclo Midget was all smiles. They swatted paws. He had been looking for Johnny to show him the silly money they were now printing for America, and in which he had been paid. Johnny pulled him into a deserted office and shook his head over the 100-credit note and the picture of Brown Limper Staffer. "The stuff is worthless," said Care. "The Brigantes just throw it into the street." Care was so happy to be out of that area. He told Johnny all about it. "And he offered me 750,000 galactic credits that I'll never see. He's one crazy cyclo, not sane like us half-humans." Care laughed over that. Care gave him the final layouts of the firing platform area. There was nothing new. Care had dug and done exactly according to plan. It was the same plan on which his raiding team had been drilled, and Care assured him everything was in place. But Care hadn't realized Johnny was going over there. When he heard that, he got very serious. "This churl is a very bad one. He's liable to have surprises. I don't like your going, Johnny." Johnny said he had to go. "What if you get a Cyclo War Party back on that platform in return?" said Care. "I don't think we will," said Johnny. "And we have a present for Cyclo." "I hope so," said Care. "It's my furry neck if they ever turn up here again. The IBI would take days to kill me." "I don't think you have anything to worry about," said Johnny. "But you stay here among these defenses. There's quite a few enemy prisoners in the place and all the Cyclos that are left. Maybe you can teach them to play cards." Care laughed, and then he said,
Did the one you call Sir Robert come back here?
Why?
Well, right in the middle of the Academy move to England, we didn't see him anymore. I wanted to check a couple of points with him, and I couldn't find him. And Dunnell Dean put in calls. He isn't in Edinburgh or Luxembourg or Russia. I thought he must be here. The reason I ask is he knows all your dispositions of forces and even some of your raid details.
Johnny was very concerned about Sir Robert. He threw off Kerr's question with, "They could never make him talk."
"The IBI could make anybody talk," said Kerr.
"We don't know the enemy has him," said Johnny. Shortly afterward, he instituted his own queries. There was no sign of Sir Robert in any area. A couple of ferry planes had gone down lately from enemy attack. They had been en route from America to Scotland. Had Sir Robert been on one of them? Sir Robert had not handled many of the details of this raid. There was no reason to change planning this late. Johnny spent his last day at the Lake Victoria mine site, neatening up what there was of his personal life. He was under no illusion that this raid was not dangerous. He wrote a letter to Chrissy that he knew the parson would read for her, and put it in plain sight on his desk, the envelope marked, "To Chrissy in case of something happening to me." He had heard one wrote wills to leave personal possessions. He started one. All he had was his horses and some odds and ends of clothes. He couldn't think of anything else he owned. Then he thought maybe Chrissy had occupied the Edinburgh house in his name, so he put down any interest he had in that or its contents and left it to Chrissy. Then he remembered he had a few books, so he left those to Patty. For the life of him, he couldn't recall anything else he owned. But maybe people would think he owned gifts, like the chrome AK-47. They weren't very many. Still, they might be. So he added a clause, "And anything else I am found to own shall be equally divided among..." And he listed the names of those men who had been closest to him. He thought for a while and then added Care. He had also heard that you signed these things and got them witnessed, so he did that. Then he put it in an envelope and put it alongside the letter to Chrissy. Feeling he had made things very orderly, he spent that evening making sure all his weapons and gear worked, that his radiation suit had no holes in it, that his air mask tanks were full, and that half a dozen kill clubs were in throwing condition. He put copies of the latest sales contract Turl had signed into his pouch. He checked the beryllium bomb case for safe carrying. He tested the edge of a hatchet to cut console cables. He felt he was ready and got a good sleep on his last night before the American raid. He had done everything he could. Now it was in the hands of the gods, or a devil like Turl. Chapter 24. 1. At the American mine site, day 92 had dawned windy and cold, and then in mid-morning, 4 hours before firing time, it had begun to snow. It was not too late for snow, but this snow was a heavy one. It came down in huge, soft flakes that swirled here and there in the wind puffs. Turl didn't care. He was jubilant. This would be his last day on Earth. So far, things had gone smoothly. From sunup to the moment it started to snow, he had been outside, checking the wiring and cables. Almost lovingly, he had put a final polish on the firing points on the poles, the points which would change space and transport him once again to his homeland. He had a wonderful story all made up. He would come in with the tale of a mutiny, of a sellout to an alien race, and how he, Turl, fighting hard, had saved the company technology and was forced, alas, to use the ultimate bomb to make certain the company was not further betrayed. They would believe him on Cyclo. They would, of course, fire a camera back and check, but it would record a black smudge. Then he would retire, saying that the strain of it all had been too much. And one fine night he would go to a cemetery and do a bit of quiet digging,
and become richer by 10 gold coffin lids and 2 billion credits that he would expose bit by bit, saying he had profited on the exchanges of the various universes. It was a perfect plan. He had been idling about for a few minutes, wondering when the Briganti special squad would come down from the mountains. He didn't like to stay outside. He hated this planet too much. But today, the breathe gas didn't seem to make him ill, and after all, it was a great day. And here they were, the Briganti special squad. They had their bundle with them just as ordered. It was long and made to look like baggage. Just before the firing, Turl would open the end of it, and one of Snith's bodyguards would pop an air mask on it, and anybody seeing it would think twice about charging the platform. He told the special squad to just dump it on the middle of the platform and then stand by. Now for the next step. Turl went back into the compound and got the small forklift he had had parked there in the corridor, got on it, and went into his office. It was really a toss-up whether he took the coffins first or the console. The coffins could stand the weather better. With a Briganti squad there, nobody could come up and steal them. They were too heavy. He paused for a moment, looking at his rug. There was a dust tread mark there. But then he thought he must have made it himself. His X mark was there on each coffin. With 4 rapid runs and very expert machine handling, he got the 4 coffins outside and dumped them on the platform. 4 trips. On each trip, he cautioned the squad to be alert and watch them. Now for the console. He tipped it up on edge to get at the hollow bottom. He unlocked a cabinet and got the booby trap and put it under the front edge of the bottom. He would not set it yet. He would give it 10 minutes from when he operated the console at firing time. The length of the firing would be 3 minutes. He had decided to take it easy on himself, and the recoil time would be about 40 seconds later. So 6 minutes and 20 seconds after he fired, bang, no console. He took it out and put it down on the oversized metal platform made for it, a platform about 10 feet by 7 feet, just inside the atmosphere armor zone. All nicely figured out. The big bus bars which operated the atmosphere armor cable had long since been installed on a raised board. He hadn't expected snow, but he had put a weather shield on the cable board. He hadn't put a shelter for the console itself, so now he had to throw a piece of tarpaulin over it to keep snow off the buttons. Turl adjusted the console's position and then got the forklift out of there. He simply dumped it. What did it matter? Those animals had left machinery all over the place. Big magnetic cranes, blade scrapers, diggers. What a mess. He got busy connecting the power cables from the poles to the console. It was quite a massive lot of cables. He didn't want to trip on his way from the console when he punched in the coordinates to the platform, so he bundled them all together. It made a snake about 6 inches in diameter. Turl double-checked the color codes. Yes, he had them all correct. He checked the armor cable by turning it on. A lot of new snow flew into the air in a circle. Yes, it worked. He turned it off. He checked the juice input to the console. All live. Turl looked at his watch. It was a full hour to firing time. Time to go in for a mouthful of Kerbango. He surveyed the office. Last time he would ever see this place, thank the devils. Turl opened his cabinets and began to dump anything and everything into the recycling bin. He opened the false backs and bottoms and consigned anything in them to oblivion. The habits of a security chief were too strong. He dumped all his reams of notes and formulas into the maw of the recycler. Then he noticed it wasn't running. Ah, of course. He must have blown the compound fuses when he put that armor cable on. Who cared? This planet was going up in smoke anyway. He went to his closet and got his dress uniform and boots out and quickly changed. He put on his parade cap. He looked at himself in the mirror. Pretty good. Turl threw a few things in a travel bag. He looked at his watch. 20 minutes to go. The snow, he could see through the compound roof, was coming down even heavier. Who cared? This book is continued on Cassette 7, Side 1.